Hi, this is Brent Feldman, and we're back with another episode of Mix and Matchbox. Today, I am joined by John MacDonald. He is the CEO at The Good. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Great. How about yourself?
Doing really well. Definitely. Thank you so much for being part of the podcast. Looking forward to jumping into some very interesting questions.
Yeah, excited to be here.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, cool. Well, I'll start, you know, the ball rolling just, pretty simply with the first one I got here, which is The Good, which is your company, right now. But prior to this, you were at a company which is somewhat, well-known, X-Plane, and other agencies, doing flash work, which, wow, I saw that listed there, and that brought back some memories. And we totally did some of that back in the day, too. But, my question is kind of like how you found your way to your company. And this isn't the first one, but how you found your way, into this company, The Good.
Yeah, well, I can definitely tell you've done your homework, which just really excites me for today's conversation. So thank you for that. Not many people realize I have a pretty extensive background in Flash. And that feels like ages ago now. But yeah, used to be part of the Flash conference circuit and speaking at conferences and attending all over the world. It was great. But really started The Good because when I was at X-Plane, I had the opportunity to do so. And X-Plane had sold to a holding company. It was actually, if you remember, Razorfish, one of the first digital firms. The gentleman, Jeffrey Dashus, who started that, sold Razorfish and Avenue A to Microsoft for now what is Bing Ads, right? It was the whole ad platform for Microsoft that they bought. And once they kind of ditched the digital agency portion of that, Microsoft didn't want to be in the agency world. So they sold that piece off. Dashus was free to go back into that world, and he decided he was going to form a mega agency, if you will, and find all these great niche down agencies and buy them up into a holding company. And he came knocking on X-Plane's door. X-Plane had been around for 20 years. And, as you mentioned, it was the tagline, it still is to this day, the visual thinking company. They would take massive complex issues and tackle those problems in a visual form. So the team that I was in charge of was the interactive team, taking those big processes that the strategist would figure out and make them an interactive tool that the company can then circulate throughout. So I remember doing a great project with UPS where we would follow a package. What happens when you hand a package over to a courier to when it gets delivered around the world? And we put cameras on boxes and like little holes in the box of the camera to show what happens going through the whole sorting facilities and everything, turn that into a great interactive experience. And they use that internally for every new employee to come in and understand where they fit into that ecosystem, right? So really at that point, I was saying, there's Flash is great, but there's so much more that could be done here to solve really just larger usability problems on the internet. The biggest issue was I was searching for a pair of shoes. I wear a size 15. It's hard to tell. I'm 6'7". I can never find shoes online. Most of them don't make them in my size. Even Nike stops their running shoes often at 12s. All the best Jordan, Air Jordans, all that kind of stuff are really hard to find in my size. So, what I got really annoyed by was the fact that I went on to find a pair of shoes and I couldn't even filter by size to find out what was in stock or even made in my size. And to me, that was so frustrating. And it was really one of the main genesis moments for starting The Good, understanding that there are bad online experiences everywhere. And I wanted to be part of eliminating those.
That's cool. That's really neat. I'm going to shape the second question a little differently because I'm now interested as you had so much experience in Flash. I guess maybe, and this may be just nostalgia's sake, but what was it actually working inside of Flash that was fun to you? Was it, the process, the end to end? Was it, the animation part of it? Was it, what was the joy there?
Well, The joy, we actually have to go back to when I was in college. I have a dual degree in computer science and visual arts, two departments that had never spoken to each other. And I was pursuing originally a computer science degree alone. And I was the student who would do everything that was technically necessary to pass in terms of writing the code, getting the functionality done. But I would spend more time actually making the interface usable. Mm-hmm. I was the person, you know, most people when you start working in graphical interfaces, they just put text boxes on the screen with a little label. It's like, put the number in here and you get the result, or start, you know, stop, whatever it was. I would make it actually usable, and like I was building an actual app. And I loved that Flash made that simple. Flash was the first, you know, it's kind of like, unfortunately, it gives you enough rope that you can hurt yourself pretty badly with it, right? And we should talk about that, I'm sure. But the reality is that I really enjoyed that aspect of being able to make something super functional, but also have flexibility that HTML at the time and JavaScript at the time was so young, did not allow you to do. Mm-hmm. And that was really where I got the bug of usability, if you will.
Very, very cool. So I feel like, you know, maybe compared to years past, people just aren't making, and maybe it's because I'm not privy to, you know, where these things are happening, but they aren't making these like web experiences. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, Flash was always at the forefront of that, you know, that people would make these just wild interactive sites. Let's mm-hmm. say maybe every single, you know, site didn't have the best usability, but at the same time, you know, they were very, you know, interesting, but now things are just much more straightforward and transactional. Mm-hmm. But the web is now touching more people, you know, than it ever has. So, you know, do you agree that you've seen this sort of transition, you know, and you know, are we as you know, either users or creators mm-hmm. missing the ability to really experiment and play with the web now?
You know, I see this too, and I believe it's a really good thing, quite honestly. This is happening because users are demanding it. Right? It's not because there's a lack of creativity with agencies or within brands. I still think that creativity is there by all means. But I think, you know, we have to look at this from the history of Flash. Flash eventually got killed, let's call it, because of Apple, right? And specifically Steve Jobs, who said that the user experiences with Flash were horrible. On the majority of Flash sites, they were. Mm-hmm. Right? It allowed creativity to take over without any bounds for usability and complete and often complete disregard for the consumer trying to use the thing, right? And it obviously didn't function on an iPhone very well either, so I understand that aspect of it. But everybody was having to figure out how to use these Flash sites one by one. And it was just super frustrating for a large portion of internet users. And I could feel their pain at times. I mean, you know, it was, I wanted to have fun with making the coolest app in Flash, but it had to be usable. Mm-hmm. And that always wasn't the case. And, you know, there was just, this is back in the days of the first edition of Stephen Krug's Don't Make Me Think, mm-hmm. right? Like, why are you guys inventing the internet every single website? Stop that. You're making consumers have too much of a cognitive load. So, fast forwarding to today, I think there's still enough room for brands to be creative. And I think that there's still room for them to ensure their website is a branded experience. I don't think that's going to disappear. But overall, I think I'm really ecstatic to see so many influential people help with the Goods mission, which is to remove all the bad online experiences until only the good remain. So I'm actually really excited that we're heading in that direction. Will it become more vanilla over time? I think there's a case to be made for that aspect. But I also think if we're using the internet to get jobs done, that it is going to be a much more effective at that.
Cool. I really respect and appreciate, you know, that answer on this one. And especially because it's like, it's one of those things where, you know, if a website's job at the end of the day is meant to like, communicate and do mm-hmm. that job well. As you talk about, reinventing the wheel, every single time you get to a new website, you're right. And you said this too, the cognitive load that gets placed mm-hmm. on the user is very high. And so they have to, reorient themselves with the, the user interface. They have to understand, what's going on. And I think a lot of times it would miss the point. Like what did you want that user to gain out of it? And if it was a whole bunch of frustration, sometimes maybe they totally nailed it. But, it is very interesting and, and somehow, I do, see also, as I ask the question mm-hmm. that it waters down, that experience, but maybe, to your point, in a good way that it's doing what it needs to do as mm-hmm. opposed to what it just could have done just for fun's sake. Yeah.
I think as a designer, I would think it'd be more sustainable for the profession. For it'd be more challenging and exciting on how to be creative without totally disrupting the user experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, I don't hear a lot of designers complain about mm-hmm. this. I hear a lot of brands often say, I'm putting my brand first online.
Mm-hmm.
And does that get in the way? Yeah, look, my first book that I wrote was called Stop Marketing, Start Selling. And the whole point of this was that there's two reasons people are at your website, and only two reasons. That's to research if the product or service can solve their pain or need. Mm-hmm. And if so, to convert as quickly and easily as possible. None of us have Facebook as our website. We're not here to just get people to stick around forever. I've had clients approach us at the good and say, yes, conversion is important and we want people to convert, but we think the best way to do that is get them to hang out on our website. And let's put a music player on the website. I'm like, no, who's here to listen to music? They're here to buy your product, hopefully, right? Let's help them do that. Having distraction of music is not gonna make that happen.
Yeah. I guess you could even say, like a designer's success is mm-hmm. getting them to do that, that thing yes. that you want that, person to do, as opposed to like, did they have fun here? Well, cool. Thank you. I do appreciate that one. All right. Well, after dealing with some like giant organizations, mm-hmm. making websites during the .com boom, which is, definitely, honestly, a very cool experience that you've had, you earned, definitely a lot of cachet probably from that, in working with these, big profile companies. Do you have any feelings on, maybe thinking about UX and the web in general, how it's changed either, kind of tactilely or philosophically how it's changed since those days?
Yeah. Dating myself, I've been doing websites and in this world since, 90s, right? So it's been a trek. And I have been very fortunate to who I've been able to work with. And for sure, most of the coolest digital experiences I've been part of happened early in my career. And I am thankful for that. But I wouldn't say they were the best or most usable or most effective digital experiences by any stretch. In fact, most were great pieces of art. Mm-hmm. Some of that stuff I did in Flash was absolutely amazing. And I still think some of the coolest stuff, but really hard to figure out if you just were coming in trying to solve a problem. And I don't think they always made it easy on the consumer to accomplish those two goals we just talked about, right? Research and buy. And so I think that's the difference. I think that it's changed from what's cool. And I mean, I don't know about you. I probably still have a stack of books somewhere that was like inspiration. It was like all these Flash websites where they take screenshots and you try to load them up and they wouldn't even load anymore, right? But there was like the pictures and you're like, I wonder how that could happen. And a lot of people were taking inspiration from video games, mm-hmm. which was really cool to see. But again, a video game, the goal often is to figure the game out, right? Not to get in and get out as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. So those were always at odds with each other.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know, and I actually even think of some video game interfaces that look stellar. You know, they're so cool, but at the same time, you're like, all right, where's the options, you know, menu? Where is it? And it can be interesting, but yeah, I think that's that. You're right. You're figuring it out, and that's maybe the joy in it. You know, that you are. You're exploring. You're learning. But yeah, with the web now, it's definitely that's not the goal. And I'm sorry, I have to say this after you mentioned, you know, like the things loading and taking screenshots flash. Actually, literally one of our very first clients, and this, I think it was in, well, we started in 06, but this was in 07, an architecture client brought us 128 meg flash site, and they go, it's not loading. And I'm like, well, they're trying to load the whole thing, you know, right up front. And and I just, yeah, it just caused some absolute nightmares for people who didn't know what they were doing. That's for sure.
Yeah, it could definitely. Flash could be an issue more, you know, again, it gave people a lot of rope and I think it created a lot of bad experiences. But thankfully, you know, looking back, I was upset with Steve Jobs. He cut off a huge community and revenue source for me personally, but has definitely been instrumental that change in where I am today.
That's cool. Well, you're on, you know, this is in addition to running The Good, and you're also an author, and you're also on the board of Feel, which helps boost sales through sales experts with AI assistance. So, you know, is there a point that, you know, having a human in the mix is important as opposed to supporting, you know, maybe a product that was just like, oh, AI assistance for sales?
For now, 100%. But I do think that will eventually catch up to be the same experiences. You know, that might be years, maybe even decades, but I do think it will happen. It doesn't mean that people don't like to purchase from people, however. And that's what I think will never change. And so that's where, you know, why I kind of jumped on with Feel when we got introduced, because, you know, they were talking a lot about how the product could help conversions. And that was where they really thought I could help fit in. I was advising on that. And true, I felt like I had some value to add there, but I also thought, well, if we're going to help conversions, this is more about that human connection and how you get people to convert into having a human to human conversation, which, you know, really is where Phil comes into the mix. They pick up the AI chatbot stops and, or where it falls short, right? So you have all these chatbots that are just pretty often not that great, pretty horrible, right? But really, they're great at answering the simple questions. When you start diving deeper and wanting to make decisions about products and you want specific details or use cases, or even just to see someone holding the product, maybe something of that sort, it often doesn't happen very, very well online. So it feels great at this and really can provide that human to human interaction that customers want, but really just don't often get as part of that digital experience.
That's really cool. This podcast isn't to prognosticate on what that future looks like, but you know, it is interesting as you know, kind of cite those examples about, like, you know, it's that it is the human touch in a lot of ways that, you know, people are still kind of looking for, and sure, they could maybe hallucinate some experiences that AI has had in order to like find some touch points of relation. You know, you could definitely get down a rabbit hole of what it's meant to do, but I agree that it's you know, it's probably not there yet to take over on its own. That's for sure.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
We'll get there though. I do think we will. We're a ways away from it, but I think we'll get there.
Yeah. Cool. You're big on CRO, conversion rate optimization, and, you know, mention in a presentation, that, you know, you're looking at a landing page as just the tip of the iceberg. And so, you know, however that you say that all, you know, that other, you know, stuff, you know, let's say that you could still have a bad landing page, even, you know, maybe taking some of all of those other tactics, you know, that are in the hidden portion, you know, may amount to what is in theory a good landing page, but you still may not convert. So, you know, what is all that stuff that is below the tip of the iceberg? All the stuff that, you know, people are kind of missing, but don't really see. What's all that stuff there?
Well, I think we should maybe start by defining landing page, because I think that varies so much. And I hear different definitions of that every day. But I believe the landing page is any page whose goal it is to get the consumer to the next step in the funnel. Not always to convert. Right? It's just get them to that next step. Okay. And that might be the conversion point you're hoping for. I would argue that is all you should be looking for out of a landing page. Because if a consumer could land on a page from a link, search results, right? Maybe a text from their friend, send them a link. Basically, it doesn't just have to be a page you're sending paid traffic to, which I think a lot of folks look at and say, okay, sending all this money to this page, I got to have it convert. Right. Okay. So with that in mind, can you have a bad landing page and still convert, which I think was part of your question? Mm-hmm. Yes. But only if your product is a must have for the consumer. So that the pain that they will go through to get that product is worth the payoff to them. Think about this. If I'm just casually looking at a product and it's a pain in the butt to actually get the information I need, I'm out. I don't have time for that. Right? I want something that's going to help aid me in that journey. So, you know, the other thing is, I don't know about you, but I assume this is the case for you as well. Even if I had a product that fit that definition, it was a must have, I really, really wanted it, I wouldn't want to put up more barriers to purchase just to do that, right? Like, why make it harder? There's no justification for that. Mm-hmm. So this kind of leads, I think, to the next part of your question is what's beneath on the iceberg, right? If we're looking at landing pages as the tip, what do you think gets in the way of those? I think there's a lot of things that get in the way that people just don't consider. You know, this is really why I wrote Behind the Click, because all of those psychological factors that are in this book, I'm sure we'll talk about eventually, but I spent the most time in the book on choice overload and decision fatigue, because those are two huge barriers that brands just want to throw up all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just roadblock after roadblock. And that looks like choice after choice, right? And choice overload is the tendency for people to become overwhelmed when faced with too many options, right? Happens in our lives every day. We face 35,000 plus decisions on an average day. Like, I don't have time to have choice overload. Talking about Steve Jobs, that's why he used to wear the same outfit every day. It was one less decision he had to make, right? It's like, I'll put on these jeans and black turtleneck, I'm good, right? Decision fatigue is something else that leads into that. That causes people to just stop making the decisions because they've been asked to make too many. So they have that choice overload, right? Where they get overwhelmed and then they get fatigued and then they just stop making decisions. This is the last thing you want somebody to do on your website if you're asking them to buy, right? So I don't know. Both of these, you know, I think they cause the visitor to close the site, thinking they might come back to it when they're less fresh or overwhelmed, and they just rarely do.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need your landing page to get people to the next step in the funnel, not to just flood them with all this information. I think, you know, a lot of people, when they think about landing pages, which is why I wanted to start with the definition, because a lot of people think about that as the long form letter page that used to be really common 5-10 years ago, where you'd have a landing page and you want it to be a sales letter and you want it to like hit on every single objection and every single piece of information. You just want people to keep scrolling. It's the world's longest pages ever. The problem is, if you look at scroll tracking, scroll maps for those pages, I would say 1% or less actually reach the bottom of that page.
Yeah.
And a lot of those, I would argue, are scrolling all the way down to try to find a footer nav, because it's often common to not have a header navigation on a landing page because, you know, people want you to stick around and read it all. So they're, again, instead of making it easy, they're increasing barriers by not giving you a choice in a navigation. They're just saying you have to read all this. And I'm like, well, I'm overwhelmed. I don't want to read all that. So really, by understanding your audience, you can use that knowledge to just help guide them to the best solution and the problem in the easiest, most effective possible way. which in turn really helps your company reach your goals too, because they convert, you want them to convert, everybody wins.
Yeah. Wow. We could do a whole nother podcast about refining decisions and landing pages. Oh my God.
That's why I wrote almost 300 pages about it.
There we go. All right. I mean, like, seriously, it's fascinating. And I do see people, you know, just kind of making the same kind of mistakes, like a lot, you know, where, yeah, it's like, oh, well, we do this and this and this and this, and we want to have, you know, like, they can click on this and have this option and then do this. And seriously, yeah, people are hit with so much every, you know, day that, yeah, that you might as well make it easier for them. And it's funny, like, I know that that even extends into, like, nomenclature of menus, you know, of just like, don't try to invent a new name for it. Like, you know, that's not helpful to your users. So, yeah.
No. Yeah. Conventions are conventions for a reason. Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Wow. See, whole nother podcast. But anyway, another soundbite that I grabbed was that you can't read the label inside the jar. And I really like this. And as long as from just that soundbite, I'm interpreting this correct. And hopefully I am, you can correct me if I'm not, but you know, obviously you can't get that perspective by, you know, when you're inside, you know, that sort of that jar. So, you know, I guess, how do you help clients take that outsider perspective and get a better view of what's really going on?
Yeah, I love that quote. I say it all the time. I think my team is at the good is tired of me saying it. But it's so true, right? It really, the way to get out of the jar is to just talk to your consumers. And too many brands don't do that. The reality is that a brand's team is likely the last folks who should be determining a user experience. And that's because they just know too much. They're not trying to create a bad experience. They know what all the products are. They know all the details about them. They know how the navigation is sorted because they've been on the site a million times, right? But a new-to-file customer, maybe someone who did all those things we just talked about, clicked on an ad, did a search, got a text from a friend, had never been to the site before, you know, they don't have that experience. And you need to have a beginner's experience for them. Right? Somebody who's new to the brand, new to the site. And we've worked with brands where we'll ask them, you know, can you tell us why the product navigation is sorted in this manner? And I kid you not, we've had the response of, because that's how our warehouse is laid out. It just blows my mind, because how you sort something for shipping and stocking and efficiency is very likely not going to help your consumer decide if you can solve their pain or need. Yeah. And that's what the navigation should be doing. Getting them to where they want to go as quickly and easily as possible. And yeah, I was just like, wow, okay. Like, have you talked to consumers about that? And the question, the answer to that is almost always no. It's, you know, it seemed logical. It's like, it does to you, but probably not your consumers. So the best way to climb out of the jar is use the ladder of consumer research. Do user testing. It's much easier than you think. There's 100 tools out there now. The good, we offer this as a service through one of our offshoot sister brands. There is a ton of options out there for conducting user research. Remote unmoderated user research is basically where you ask someone to go to your website, record their screen and their audio, and ask them to talk out loud about the experience that they're having. And you give them, you know, a non-leading question. Like, let's say you sell t-shirts. Find the best t-shirt for you. Go. Right? Don't lead them down a path. Don't tell them what to do. And if you're able to do that and actually listen to what's happening, you'll gain so much empathy for the consumer.
Cool. Love it. And I think it's such a good point. I feel like people need that perspective, desperately. Yeah. And not just for the people who are thinking about their warehouse, like, well, if that is your consumer that works in your warehouse and knows it, you know, then you've nailed it actually.
Yeah. Right. Like, I'm glad you're making a lot of sales to your staff. Like, that's what's going to matter.
And I people all across the board, they need that feedback of just like, you know, the consumers are the people that you're mm-hmm. you're wanting to engage more, to, you know, lead down the path of hopefully more sales. And literally, if you don't know what they want, how are you going to serve them properly? But
right.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's great. Okay. So I guess, and maybe this is a good piggyback question of like, you know, you're encouraging, you know, testing and incremental. And I say that very, you know, specifically the incremental experimentation. Do you feel like there's a natural tendency towards wanting to, you know, tear down and build up? And is that dangerous or deleterious in any way?
Yeah. We actually have t-shirts at The Good that say get 1% better every day. So you can probably guess the rabbit hole I would go down here. But yeah, look, the best way to think about this is you can either burn down the entire house and start over, or you can renovate room by room, right? And just like some homes that have been neglected for years and years, you may need to burn it down and start over. It might be worth it, right? But most homes don't get raised like that. They get renovated, right? This is where house flipping is all over TV shows now. I mean, like, very few people are knocking houses down and starting over. They're renovating. And the same goes for websites. The vast majority need a renovation instead of that large, really just, it's a massive capital expenditure to start over. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, usually when you start over, it becomes the, what they call HIPPO, right? Highest paid person's opinion, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It really becomes their decisions, and the consumers seem to get left out. But when you renovate, often they want feedback. So it really goes hand in hand there, where brands are much more likely to include the customer when they renovate versus when they start over. Because a lot of times when you start over, you're going back to the creativity becomes key. Mm-hmm. Oh, right. We have this great opportunity to make the site look great. And maybe we could reorganize a few things that have always been problemsome for us and add these new features. What are the new features that weren't there 5 years ago when we last launched the site? And you lose the consumer in all of that. Or if you renovate, you're not thinking about, oh, we have to have functionality. We have to have this feature. Instead, you're saying, okay, how do we make the best navigation? Because we're overhauling our navigation now. Let's make just focus on making the best navigation. Now, I argue about all this because I think you're able to learn a lot more from consumers who are using your site if you incrementally optimize based on those behaviors. Right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just guessing or basing your decisions on what you think should happen.
Yeah. It's providing good inspiration as we're thinking about refining our website, but actually mm-hmm. the whole goal that we have right now is to make a better user experience at the mm-hmm. end of the day. You know, like, I think we did this like 3-4 years ago, and now we're actually like, how do we just make it easier? You know, at the time when we made the last one, we're like, all right, cool. Well, let's play with this design style and these things here. And
yeah, you're like, it's a portfolio site. We want it to look like representative of what we can do, right? But if you go to thegood.com, you'd see it's a pretty generic site. I mean, it's not that it looks unprofessional by any means. The goal here is to communicate what we do and who we do it for immediately.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you that a number of SaaS brands, you go to their website and you're like, what do you do? Mm-hmm. How can you help me? I'm confused. And I don't understand that. Like, you know, just say clearly the site's not for me. Tell me who it's for.
Yeah.
And I'll know. Okay. I should opt out.
Yeah.
Instead of wasting my time looking around for that solution that probably isn't for me.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. All right. I got one little extra add-on question here.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, let's say like Facebook maybe is a fine case study in mm-hmm. you know, in changing little by little. You know, we've seen the platform evolve, but at no mm-hmm. point did they tear it down yep. and build the whole thing back up. You know, it's been like, oh, they, you know, switched up maybe the look and feel of this or move this mm-hmm. notification in there. But how would you, as Facebook, know when you've done the right thing or the wrong thing, that every mm-hmm. time you get a cacophony of user feedback that is usually negative?
Well, I think you've said it right. It's the incremental approach, where eventually you're going to hit a wall where consumers aren't going to care, or they're going to care way too much. And you want that feedback, and you're never going to please everybody. Maybe not Facebook, but there's a great example with Amazon that popped in my head, where Amazon wanted to change the background color of their site. And they were really concerned that if they changed, they did use their testing on a whole wide range of colors. And what they found was, if they changed the color, consumers thought it was a fake site. They were like, oh, this is a fake Amazon. This isn't the one I'm used to. So they're like, wow, we really can't change this. We didn't think that people would be like, oh, this is a fraud, right? I'm not at the right Amazon, so I'm not going to buy. It wasn't that they didn't like the color or that it was distracting in some other way. It was just, this doesn't look like the Amazon I know. Mm-hmm. And what they ended up doing was literally changing it bit by bit over the course of, I want to say it was a year, I think, where, you know, if I can get really nerdy, I guess, but there's hex codes for colors on web. They went through, they knew where they started and where they ended, and they wanted it. They just changed it bit by bit to get to the shade that they wanted. And that way it was imperceptible to humans. We would go to the website and be like, oh yeah, it didn't change from what I saw yesterday, but it had slightly changed. And it's a great case study in the incremental approach, really having a psychological tie-in.
That's great. Yeah, just moving people along slowly. That's great. Cool. Well, actually touching on psychological principles leads right into the next question. You know, that using psychological principles can help, you know, lead you to make more effective solutions for your user, you know, being more understanding, empathetic, you know, and understanding the things that, you know, they you know, will respond to. But there's also a dark side. You know, there's I've heard it called dark UX. And they can frustrate users. And speaking of Amazon, I just had one yesterday. I just tried to unsubscribe from Prime Music, and what a pain in the butt. You know, they provide, you know, hurdles to cancellations and, you know, other things that, you know, may lead to lost profit.
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line on things that are, you know, it's good for us, good for you, versus it's good for us, it's not good for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of it comes down to intent. Okay. Now, you gave a great example. There's a lot of subscriptions out there that are just hoping you don't see it on your credit card statement every month, right? I mean, think about how many TV commercials there are now popping up saying, oh, we'll tell you when, you know, we'll help you find all these recurring charges on your statements that you're not using anymore and cancel them. There's whole services out there that help you do that now. So it's obviously a problem, right? But really put simply, the goal is not to use psychological principles to trick customers, right? You don't want to trick them into buying more than they came for, or choosing your company over competitors. Like, that's just, it's essential to avoid those, because it's a practical issue as much as it is an ethical one. And I say that because if your company were to put these tactics in play, and you're essentially manipulating your customers, right? You're going to attract customers outside of that target market who would ultimately be unhappy with your product. So you're selling to unhappy customers now, right? You're going to increase that return volume because you've probably lied to them along the way or misled them in some way. Even if it wasn't overly intentional, you created a consumer who's going to be unhappy and want to return it. You're really going to kill your customer sentiment. It's just going to plummet. And you're going to have unsatisfied customers. Again, not helpful in any way, shape, or form. Lastly, and most annoying for me, I think, would be to waste time, money, resources that could have went into attracting those who do need your product or service, right? Focus on that. Why not focus on providing the best possible experience so people have a great customer sentiment, want to talk about your brand, all these positives that can come out of that. But conversion for conversion's sake, to bring in money in the short term, okay, but it's going to do a lot more harm in the long run.
Yeah. And I like the focus on, you know, even a reflection on intent. You know, it's it's like, you know, why are you doing this? And maybe just, you know, sharing the thought about it, because that can yield that conversation, which really is like, are we doing this for the right reason or not?
Well, think about how many pop-ups have you seen in e-commerce where you just get to the site and it pops up and it's like 10% off, give us your email. And then there's no close button to be had. There's a button or a link of text below the field that says, no, I don't like discounts. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I don't like your site. Like, yeah. You know, it's not that I don't like discounts. I was in the middle of something and you interrupted me with your pop-up, offering me a discount for something I don't even know I need or want. And you're telling me that I'm not going to get this offer again unless I give you my email address now. How does this possibly work? I mean, think about it as in a retail store. And this is where a lot of people just can't see somebody on the other side of the screen. So they don't treat them like a human.
Yeah.
Right. If it was a retail store and I walked into a store, an associate popped out in front of me, put a clipboard in my face, said, give me your email address for a discount, I'd be like, what are you doing? I'll buy. There's tons of other stores that sell this stuff. I'm going to go elsewhere. Right. It just doesn't make sense. But because you can't see the human, you're treating them like a number in Google Analytics. You go ahead and do it.
Yeah, definitely. As soon as you started that, I thought of the actual in-person literal translation and my mind went there. I was like, all right, next at Costco, it's spin the wheel, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Think about how much that would hurt Costco's brand, who, you know, is all about premium products at a good, I mean, their Kirkland is like, I just read an article, like their vodka is made by Grey Goose or something, like one of the premier brands, right? And like, mm-hmm. Nobody wants to talk about it because it's got Kirkland's name on it. But everybody who buys is like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Costco went around and started spinning a wheel, I'd be like, man, I thought it was at Walmart or something, right? Yeah. Like, not the brand they want.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, I have one last question for you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's really around biases. Biases are a thing that we all have. And mm-hmm. I'm sure even yourself. You know, as you like to help businesses see through them, do you think that, you know, you may have your own underpinnings of these, you know, even though you try mm-hmm. to help people see around them, you know, even though you're operating under a set of principles and best practices mm-hmm. that are ingrained in you from years of experience and teaching and, you know, learned, you know, sort of things that, like, you know, mm-hmm. obviously that still colors, you know, the way you see things, but, you know, yeah. How do you separate yourself as much as possible from those mm-hmm. sort of internal markers?
Yeah. I guess I'll start by saying, yeah, I most certainly have my opinions and they're formed by my experiences over 20 years of plus now of building websites and being involved in that world. And the thing to understand and to have empathy for your customers, because your site visitors have their opinions formed by their own experiences that are going to be different than yours, mine, anyone, the brands, right? So it's much more effective to shift the focus from blindly applying tactics to understanding the psychology behind them. Right. Once you understand the psychological principles, it's so much easier to separate yourself from them uh-huh. and take a step back and just have empathy. Again, that empathy word for the visitors on the other side of the screen that we just talked about. You can't see them, but you still need to have empathy for them. And that was actually my main reason for writing Behind the Click. You know, the unique perspective of this book lies in its ability to translate psychological principles into practical steps that companies can implement on their website or digital journey and increase that experience's effectiveness, but also the sentiment that comes along with that. So doing that, though, it continues to further that mission I've mentioned, right? Of removing all those bad online experiences until only the good remain.
Awesome. Well, that's wonderful. I appreciate that. And I feel like everybody needs to be encouraged to have more empathy for their user, their customer. Mm-hmm. You know, it just helps all around. Put yourself in their shoes.
Sure.
You touched on earlier, you know, as we were chatting, I know you have a book right now. Yeah. You have even a proof, a physical
copy. The physical copy showed up today. So Behind the Click. And it will be available everywhere books are sold April 15th. And if you want a preview chapter before then, or even a free sample chapter after it's fully launched, you go to thegood.com/BTC for Behind the Click. So thegood.com/BTC for Behind the Click. And I'm really excited about this. As I told you earlier, it took me over a year to get this out. It's almost 300 pages. It's quite a thick book, but it's an enjoyable read packed with the psychological principles as well as examples of how they're being used and how you can deploy them as well, and an understanding of what your consumers are going through, right? So that when you see a checklist of best practices for optimization, you're saying, okay, this one applies to me, or man, these don't apply at all, or at the very least have some understanding of why they might be, and I'll put that in air quotes, be best practices, right? Which is a whole nother podcast episode we could do, I'm sure. But
totally. Oh my gosh, so many rabbit holes. Good information all around, though. I really appreciate it. So yeah, John, like seriously, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for your answers.
Yeah, well, thanks for doing your homework and asking such great questions. I really enjoyed myself.
Oh, awesome. All right. Well, this has been another episode of Mix and Matchbox. I'm your host, Brent Feldman. We'll be back soon with more content. Please like and subscribe. Thanks.